Okay, welcome back. The coronavirus conflagration continues. There is a lot. Let me pull up my headlines here. I've got a couple things I want to mention. Let's see. They're up now, all the new ones. Your evening newspaper, the full day's report. Okay. Billy Gates, and this is a weird one, or is it? Billy Gates negotiated a $100 billion contract dealing with contact tracing. It was a contact tracing deal with a Democrat congressman, sponsor of a bill 6 months before the coronavirus pandemic. You have to read that one, ponder that. The White House ignored warnings as it pushed for reopenings of schools and restaurants and life. Not a surprise, we've reported about that for a long time here. 2020's economic destruction due to the state's coronavirus responses will pale in comparison to what's coming. How big a bite has coronavirus taken out of the Big Apple? Pretty big bite. Manufactured pandemic and economic collapse is a boon for billionaires. Well, no matter how you look at it, there's no question the billionaires got much richer. Henry is standing by there. One more note here. Gilad Atzmon, the brilliant Jewish-born journalist who's living in the UK, wrote a very good piece today. He always does. The question concerning COVID-19 and technologies. Good things to just ponder. Let's see, what else do we have here? The World Health Organization is warning that an uncontrolled lifting of coronavirus restrictions would be a recipe for disaster. Okay? All right, so here we go. Dr. Henry Nyman is back, as always, with an update. We had a weekend. The numbers are lagging a little bit, as they always do over the weekend. Henry, welcome back. Hope you had a nice time.
Well, it's good to be back, Jeff. And, yeah, the numbers do lag a little bit, but there were a couple additional stories that have come out over the weekend. And they're all kind of pointing in one direction. It is not a good direction. And I kind of issued a warning last week about these very weird stories that are starting to appear, and that the weird stories were going to try to minimize the significance of the pandemic. And you know, there were a couple examples of claims that PCR data wasn't real unless you isolated the virus, in spite of there being 92,000.
Yeah, but you can't. How can you isolate the virus, Henry? It doesn't exist, remember? Don't forget that. There is no virus.
Right. Well, that's actually what they were saying. Just because you got a PCR positive doesn't mean the virus exists. And right. Then they were claiming that it, in fact, didn't exist. These were just kind of random sequences that were pulled out of a mixture genetic information in clinical samples, and that it didn't prove anything. And the latest example of the minimization effort apparently was tweeted by Trump, which claimed that the CDC was quietly rolling back the number of deaths due to coronavirus because only 9,000 had died without any pre-existing conditions. And so they're implying that I don't know, they had 153,000. I'm not sure where they even came up with that number, because the latest number is closing in on 200,000. But they said of the 153,000, only 9,000 died without pre-existing conditions. In implying that those were the only true COVID deaths. And that's somewhat akin to, you know, the nonsense that Russia puts out, that they have a much lower fatality rate than anybody else in the world because they have doctors to say, well, this person didn't die from COVID. They were infected with COVID, but they died because of something else. And this was going along those lines. And it seemed to be pretty widely circulating. I actually got an email with it, and some people asked me about it. My email was headlined, "Shock Report. This week, CDC quietly updated COVID numbers. Only 9,210 Americans died from COVID-19 alone. Rest had different other serious illnesses." Mm-hmm. Well, to give you an idea what a serious illness is, if you go to the CDC website and they talk about underlying conditions for COVID that put you at increased risk, one of those underlying conditions is obesity. Obesity as defined by a BMI of 30 or higher.
What's a BMI?
In the United States, right. In the United States, using that definition, how many people are obese? Adults in the United States. Take a guess.
65 to 70%.
Yeah, well, not quite that high. 70 million people.
Right.
70 million adults 70. Are obese. 35 yeah. million men, 35 million women.
And how many are overweight? So, yeah, you got a lot of those, yeah, too.
I think it's 99 million total.
Mm-hmm.
The point is, you're missing the point here. The point is, those 70 million people that are obese, if they die from COVID, they died with an underlying condition.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had a BMI of 30. That's an underlying condition for COVID.
I see.
In addition, they have other things that are listed are asthma. Pregnancy. If you're pregnant and you get COVID, you had an underlying condition.
Whose list
smoking.
Is this again, please?
Smoking.
Whose list is this? This is World Health Organization or CDC? Whose list
CDC.
Is this? Okay.
This is CDC's list.
So pregnancy, smoking, got it.
Right. Asthma. So it, I'm only listing a few of them. I mean, under increased risk, cancer, chronic kidney disease, COPD, mm-hmm. immunocompromised mm-hmm. state, obesity, mm-hmm. serious heart condition, sickle cell disease, type 2 right. diabetes. And then they might be increased risk, asthma, cerebral vascular disease, cystic fibrosis, hypertension, or high blood pressure. I should have mentioned that. High blood on the list. Immunocompromised states, neurological conditions such as dementia, liver disease, pregnancy, pulmonary fibrosis, smoking, thalassemia, type 1 diabetes. So the fact that you've got an underlying condition, most people that have a BMI of 30 don't expect to die this year. They just don't think it's a fatal condition. But if they get COPD and they die, they died with an underlying condition. So these guys want to take a look at this list and say only 9,000 died without any underlying condition, ignoring the fact that a very high percentage of the population has underlying conditions, including pregnancy, including smokers, including high blood pressure, including type 2 diabetes, including obesity. So if you go through that list, you get a pretty high percentage of the U.S. population has an underlying condition that puts them at higher risk for complications with COVID. So this quiet update was no update at all. CDC just said that, you know, 9,000 didn't have any underlying conditions. The others had underlying conditions. They didn't say they died because of the underlying condition, as the article implied. They said that they had an underlying condition which might increase their risk of severe illness with COVID.
Mm-hmm.
So that is what was tweeted by Trump. So Trump is trying to downplay the disease. He tried to talk it away and was unsuccessful. People are still concerned about it. So now he's saying it's not a problem.
Yeah,
only 9,000
right.
people died. You know, it wasn't 150,000, or it wasn't 180,000, or it wasn't
right.
closing in on 200,000, or it won't hit 300,000 by December 1st. And then there's a related story. And it's very, very closely related to that. That is that Scott Atlas, your favorite name, who considers himself anti-Fauci, quote unquote, and is on the COVID task force. His recommendation is, don't worry about the virus. Herd immunity will take care of it. Let her rip. So he's ready to go ahead and jump in with both feet, ignore it. It's not being denied. They haven't come out and said, well, we're not considering that. That's his recommendation. He was used by Trump and I don't know. I think there's only been about a couple meetings since then. It was several weeks ago, but there really haven't been many task force updates. And he was introduced as the newest member. And frankly, I don't think since he was introduced that any other scientist has really been
he's been it
involved with the task force update. The rollout of the new revolutionary treatment using antibodies, convalescent sera antibodies, and then that pretty well trashed the reputation of the FDA when he kind of said, well, we're going to give that an approval for emergency use, and that it reduces mortality by 35%.
Uh-huh.
And that statement was not supported by anyone, including the Mayo Clinic that did the study. And the Mayo Clinic said that their recommendation was further study because they were really kind of comparing apples to oranges. They were comparing how well people did that were treated in 3 days or less versus how well people did who were treated 4 days or more. And there were no controls. And, you know, most scientists say, well, you know, data without control, you know, that's not really data because you don't really know what it means because you don't have a control. So you got a number, but why you got the number, you have no idea. And the Mayo Clinic said they had no idea. But Trump had an idea. He said it was because of the antibodies. And this was revolutionary, even though it's been around for 100 years. And that this was a major breakthrough. Mm-hmm. And that there was a lot of pushback to the FDA for making that announcement. And remember on Friday, I said there were two people that had been fired. One was Emily, what was her last name? Anyway, she had been fired after 11 days on the job. Uh-huh. And then there was a second person that had been fired. And I didn't know the details on the second person other than they said it was just a coincidence that he had been fired also. And it turns out what he had done just before getting fired mm-hmm. is he had recommended to the FDA that they make an announcement to say that their claim of 35% reduction in mortality was somewhat misleading.
Somewhat.
So he was trying to get the FDA to clean up this major flop. And because he recommended they make an announcement to kind of get back into the good graces of the scientific community, he was coincidentally fired immediately. And that gives you a little bit better idea on exactly what's going on with the FDA and the CDC uh-huh. and Trump's plans for the pandemic. And then along those lines, there was another report that came out over the weekend, and that was kind of a boo-boo that Florida had prepared a report on going back to school. And the report noted that between, I believe it was August 15th and August 24th, in the Florida school system, counting daycare, grade school, and high school, they had, I believe it was over 700 positives of students and teachers. And that was written up in a report. Mm-hmm. And it was not made public, but it was somewhere at their website. And so if you dug down deep enough, going down one link after another link, you actually got to that report and you could read that report. And then that was covered in the, I think, Miami newspaper. And the governor said, that wasn't ready for public release. And that shouldn't have been released. And mm-hmm. and he didn't say the data wasn't accurate. And he did say it shouldn't have been released. And that gives you a little bit of an idea on why the union is, I believe, suing the governor for ordering everybody back to class. Mm-hmm. And that is why there's considerable concern about what is really going on in Florida and how ready are they to go back to school and how forthcoming is the data that they are releasing, since they've got something that seemed to be a pretty relevant number on how many people had tested positive in the first week or so of class, mm-hmm. or 10 days, I guess, of class. And mm-hmm. Then when the report is identified and written up in the paper. I said, oh, that wasn't supposed to come out. So there's a lot going on with the pandemic. The pandemic's numbers are down a little bit, but as you said, they're always down over the weekend. They come up again on Tuesday through Friday. And over the weekend, the Johns Hopkins number got to 6 million, hit the 6 million mark for the United States this weekend.
Cases.
And,
cases.
I'm sorry, 6 million cases. And that report kind of lags a little bit from the Worldometer report. And just to give you an idea, they passed the 6 million cases mark 211,796 cases ago. So they're up to 6,211,000. Mm-hmm. And their deaths are up to 187 at 736. So that would indicate that the middle of next month, the U.S. will hit the 200,000 mark on deaths. And so the question is, well, if we already got 200,000 dead in the next couple of weeks or so, what will happen if we tried the herd immunity trick? How many people will die trying to get 70% of the population immune to the virus? And what do you think the estimates are for how many deaths it would take to get that 70% immunity level? Want to pick a number?
That's a toughie. I'm not good at this. Go ahead.
Okay, well, the projected number of deaths that would happen to get the U.S. to 70% of the population to have immunity would be 2 million. Huh. Now, 2 million deaths, just to give you an idea, if you took all the people, all of the Americans that have died in all of the wars that America has fought since the Revolutionary War.
Not there. Yeah.
You would get 1.3 million deaths.
Mm-hmm.
And if you threw in the 1918 pandemic, you would get another 600,000 Americans.
Still not
and you'd
there.
Get it almost up to 2 million. So, right. So if you took everybody that died in every war the U.S. fought and everybody that died in the 1918-1919 pandemic, not 1917, the one Trump talks about all the time because nobody died in that one, you wouldn't reach 2 million deaths. And that's the game plan. The game plan is to let her rip.
That's Scott Atlas's game
Atlas.
Plan.
Yeah, Scott Atlas. Right. Zero background in epidemiology. Zero background in virology.
Yeah, perfectly qualified.
Zero background in molecular biology. He looks at pictures. He looks at MRI, radiological. Data from people with neurological diseases. And 10 years ago, before he retired, so he hasn't done that for 10 years. And he's never done anything with epidemiology. He's never done anything with virology.
Right.
And he said, looks good to me. And, of course, Trump says, oh, really? Well, that doesn't sound too hard. What do we have? We have to do nothing, correct? Oh, yeah, that's it. Just do nothing and see what happens. And so I had said a few weeks ago, that it just seemed like Trump wanted to see how many people could get infected. that he was ready to open up the schools, not doing anything to prepare the schools, not providing any money to basically make any types of modifications, adjustments to open up the schools in the middle of a pandemic in states that had 20% positive rates on individuals that were being tested. And he just said, let her rip. Yeah, time for school. You don't go to school. We don't give you money. That's what he said. And the governors, you know, said, okay, that's what we're supposed to do. You have to have 5 days of in-class teaching. Otherwise, we're going to withhold your funding. So they passed it on down to the individual school boards and districts. So it's a big experiment. But a lot of the schools in the north, you know, they didn't open, you know, in early December or mid-December. August. They either opened in late August, or some of them aren't open yet. They're going to be opening, right after Labor Day. And my guess is that what's going to happen with COVID is going to be very similar to what happened with swine flu. That swine flu started at about the same time. It started in the spring, and it kind of went down a little bit over the summer. And then it just took off when school started. Now, there really weren't a whole lot of restrictions for the swine flu. And as I said previously, here in Pittsburgh, by November, before the vaccine was introduced, 40% of serum samples that were tested and collected in 2009, or probably for the latter half of 2009, were positive for swine flu. So that indicated I still didn't get up to the 70% mark, which is what your need for herd immunity. That happened in a few months, but the virus basically hit every school district in the country, and many had 10% absenteeism, both in the student population as well as the faculty population. But if there were 40% of the students and faculty who were infected with COVID, and then they were bringing that virus home, the number of deaths would skyrocket. The ability of healthcare delivery to handle that number of deaths would not be sufficient. People would be dying because they didn't have any ICU beds. They would run out of PPEs, and healthcare workers would be dying because they didn't have the proper equipment.
Well, absolutely. I'm very concerned.
And this is, let's see what happens. And this is seriously being considered. This is not just, you know, idle chatter. This is the latest over the weekend, and this is what the anti-Fauci has to say. He's saying herd immunity, that's the way to go. You know, it's going to happen sooner or later. And actually, before the weekend, there were some comments by administration sources that were kind of toying with that idea, and essentially saying that, you're going to get it eventually anyway.
You're going to get it eventually. Right.
And that's what they said to comment about Trump's acceptance speech to in front of an audience of 1,500, with very, very few of the 1,500 wearing masks. And even though that was outside, the chairs were literally, you know, touching, and the audience was shoulder to shoulder. There was no social distancing, and there were very few masks, and that's bad not only for the people who were in the audience, but that was bad for anybody that was watching it, because they're saying, well, you know, they're not wearing masks. Why do we need to wear masks?
Well, and, picture's worth a thousand words. You got it.
Right. And they took that same position in Charlotte, where they, it wasn't as big. I think they only had about 350 people, but that wasn't outside. That was inside, and they didn't wear masks either. And, a couple of the staff and a couple of the attendees are already positive. And there's almost certainly more to come there. So this is part of the reason the U.S. is number one in the world, is because not a good example. There's, you know, as you said previously, there's a mask debate. So some people are of the opinion that they really don't need a mask, and it's all a hoax. And it's unnecessary. And in fact, when Trump had his rally in New Hampshire on Friday, there is a state ordinance that basically says for gatherings of 100 or more, they need to wear masks. So for this rally that Trump had on Friday, they were handing out masks, and then they made an announcement over the loudspeakers that says, according to ordinance da-da-da-da-da in New Hampshire, you are required to wear a mask. Please put your mask on. And the response was the audience booed, and they didn't put the mask on. So, that's yet another example on how well this herd immunity is going to work in the U.S. with more and more people being infected and a significant portion of the population insisting that masks are not necessary and that mask wearing can't be mandated, and that, you know, people, they don't know anybody that's got infected with the virus, and they'll cite this report that I just gave. Only 9,000 people have died in the U.S. from COVID without underlying conditions, and they'll downplay the number of deaths. Meanwhile, if you look at the charts for excess deaths that the CDC puts out, and I've mentioned this before, but it's also worth repeating, that the excess deaths does not require a COVID diagnosis, does not require a doctor to say what the cause of death was. The tables are the graphs are generated simply by counting up the number of death certificates, regardless of cause, and tallying those per with respect to location and date. And then little graphs of the number of deaths in each of the states. If you go to the CDC's website, it's a pull-down menu. You can pick the state. The data generally lags a couple of weeks, as far as just getting on the graph.
Right.
Right, uh-huh. because it takes that long to get the death certificates and then to report the death certificates. So there's a couple of weeks lag. And then even on the data that's put up, for about a month's worth of data, it's really incomplete that each week it gets updated. So it's not just that they're missing the two most recent weeks, that the more recent weeks that are on the graph do get updated because all of the reports aren't in yet after 10 days or 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 weeks. And when you look at those graphs, they go at the CDC site, they go back 3 years. They show you three years worth of data. And what you see when you go through those is that you don't really get excessive deaths. That generally the number of deaths that are reported are kind of in line with historic levels, and they draw a little line above, you know, what the threshold is to be considered a week that has excessive deaths. And the bars, you know, there's a little bit of space between the top of the bar and where that line is. And then occasionally, if it's a bad flu season, like it was a couple of years ago, you'll get two or three or even 4 weeks in a row where you've got excess deaths. Those weeks, to get that many in a row, are almost always in January. They're kind of in the middle of the flu season. And their numbers that just barely get above the threshold. And then if you take a look at this year, what you see for many of the states that had significant outbreaks, like New York or New Jersey or Connecticut or Pennsylvania or Louisiana or Michigan or Illinois, and you take a look at them, and they had very large outbreaks, very large numbers above the threshold back in April and May and June, and then the numbers kind of started to go down again, and they started to get near the threshold, and they started to go back up again. Mm-hmm. And that these states have been above the threshold for the past 20 weeks. They started 20 weeks ago, and they have 20 weeks in a row of excess deaths. And that doesn't have anything to do with whether they had an underlying condition. That just means they're dead. And you don't get 20 weeks in a row of excess deaths unless you're in the middle of a pandemic. The last time there were 20 weeks in a row with excess deaths was 1918. So the number of deaths that are in the current 2020 pandemic are unprecedented, have not been matched in over 100 years. They happened in 1918 and 1919, and there's been nothing like that since. There have been pandemics. There have been flu pandemics. There's a flu pandemic in 1957, and there was another one in 1968, and there was another one in 2009. And none of those look like the current pandemic. So they're dying in record numbers.
Yeah. Yeah. What I'm concerned about, Henry, is the flu season. That's going to possibly make this really a catastrophe. Filled hospitals, ICU beds gone, the whole thing.
The flu season is a possibility, but exactly how much it'll impact is not yet clear. And I kind of mentioned this before, but it bears repeating. And in fact, there's some treatments that are starting using interferon. So interferons are some of the proteins that show up in a cytokine storm. They're cytokines that can target various types of infections. And some of them, like interferon, actually target RNA viruses. And both flu as well as coronaviruses are RNA viruses. And so they are attacked by interferon. And so it's possible that the defenses against COVID will limit the number of cases of the flu if COVID is firmly in place. And that's kind of what happened with the swine flu. And just briefly, the swine flu was very similar to what happened with COVID. It started in the spring, and a lot of students got it at spring break, and it spread around. But, but in the spring, it was kind of spotty. That you know, if somebody went down to Mexico and they got infected, and they came back and went to school, they infected other students. They ended up going to the nurse's office. They ended up sending him home. But it wasn't like it was everywhere. I mean, if you recall, there was a one private school in Queens. There was one of the first schools that was reported. They had hundreds of cases in that one school. But it didn't really spread to all the schools in New York. There were a few schools that ended up being infected. Uh-huh. Most of them weren't as infected as that one school was in the fall. In the late spring. Uh-huh. And the same thing happened here in Pittsburgh. In the spring, you didn't really hear that much about it. And I know there was one middle school that got infected. But it wasn't widespread. You know, you kind of read about it. It was widespread enough to be declared a pandemic. It took the WHO a little while. I thought they were a little slow, but they declared the pandemic, I think, in May or so of 2009. And but it wasn't really that widespread. And then it started showing up as soon as school started in the fall. And in the South, it actually started in August. And then it started hitting the northern schools in late August or early September. And here in Pittsburgh, it was kind of like a mild version came by first. It was school first started. Kids had a cough. And it was going around, but they weren't that sick. And they weren't missing school, and they weren't running a fever, and they weren't really getting tested. And then about 6 weeks later, then things changed very dramatically, and people had fevers, and they were missing school, and it was a full-blown outbreak. And that gives, you know, I'm pretty confident that all of those students that were coughing at the beginning of the school season were infected with the virus. They weren't that sick, and they didn't develop immunity. And as a result, they got infected when there was higher viral loads. They got infected again, even though it was only about 6 weeks later. And then they did develop symptoms, and they were sent home, and they did miss school. And there were widespread absenteeism. And I strongly suspect that the same thing is happening with COVID. And there have been a couple examples, and you had actually cited one as a headline Friday, and I didn't actually get to it. But that was a 25-year-old in Nevada. That person actually had been infected twice. He was infected the first time in, I believe, April, and then he was infected again in May, and it was only about a month later where he got the second infection. So he had recovered, he tested negative, and then he was positive again. And they got the sequence on both infections, and they were both the Italian strain. But there were, so there are like five markers that, or four markers that determine the Italian strain, and both isolates had all four of those markers. But the first infection had like four additional mutations or polymorphisms. And the second one had five, and they weren't, and they didn't match at all. So the four that were on the first one were not present in the second one, and the five that were in the second one were not present in the first one. And that based upon those, that sequence differences, even though they were the same strain, they concluded that the virus can't change that quickly, and you can't have all of the markers disappear in a month and then be replaced by five other ones. And they concluded that this person really was infected twice. It wasn't that the original one was just residual. Mm-hmm. And there had been a published paper that had been accepted for publication from an individual that was in Hong Kong. And in Hong Kong in the spring, and then there was like a 3 or 4 month gap where he took a trip to Spain, and he got infected again. And in that case, they were very different. They were actually two different clades. The first there was clade B, which was the clade that was found in the Middle East, and the second one was the Italian strain, clade G. And so they weren't similar at all, and the gap, as well as the different lineages, as well as different sets of mutations in each, led them to conclude that this person had been infected two different times. And even though he was had strong symptoms on the first one, it wasn't enough to prevent him from getting infected by a different clade when he took another trip a few months later.
Right.
And I have heard about other examples where it looks like the sequences are different and they're being prepared for publication. And so the idea that if you let it rip and go for herd immunity, that you may get a lot of dead bodies and you may get a lot of people that got infected, but they may not really have a good enough immune response.
We still don't know how long
the
immune response lasts.
Exactly.
For sure.
Exactly.
We don't know.
So why not do an experiment? See how many Americans can die. I mean, if Trump gets 2 million Americans, he would have the record as the the biggest killer of Americans in the world. I mean, he would be number one. Everybody would say, yeah, more people died while he was president from
what you're saying is correct.
Than any other.
Comorbidities or not, that would be the case.
Right.
That would
right.
be it.
And you know, if you've got a relative who's, you know, 20 pounds overweight or so and got a BMI up to 30 and gets COVID and they die. So, well, you know, a little overweight. What do you expect? You know, so it's, some of these comorbidities are not the types of comorbidities that, most people think of as being,
No, I agree. That's true.
A serious underlying condition that would, mm-hmm. lead to death from COVID when you weren't even necessarily that old. I mean, you might be 60, 65, something like that,
right.
and have diabetes and end up dead. Or you might be a little bit overweight enough so that you got a BMI up to 30 and have the same thing happen. But the main point is that these stories are coming out fast and furious. They're basically trying to discount.
Remember when I said last week there's been a change in the texture? I've been saying this.
Right. And so what's going to happen, my prediction, is with or without a big flu season, this opening the schools alone is going to lead to a significant increase in cases. And the number of cases this fall will be much higher than the number of cases right now, and that'll be associated with a large increase in deaths. And then if flu shows up in addition to that, then it will overwhelm
totally overwhelming to the entire country. We'll see. Thank you, Henry. Yeah. As always, talk to you next time. Keep up the great work. Appreciate it.
Okay, very good. Okay, right. Take care.
Good night. All right, Dr. Henry Nyman, and we'll be right back with you tomorrow night. Eat good food. Most importantly, take care of yourselves. Talk soon.